The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Welcome to Zoomed Leadership with your host, John Schmidt. This program will take you behind the scenes and deepen your understanding about the patterns and perspectives of leadership today. Now, here's your host, John Schmidt.
Welcome, everybody, to this week's edition of Zoomed Leadership. It is your host, John Schmidt. And again today, as I have been and will continue to do, we'll be taking you out to the big picture in to the up close and personal and toward a world of desirable futures. And as in any good piece of music or in a symphony, this series too does have a through line, and ours revolves around the understanding, the examining of what I'm calling the front of life, the macro level systems, the structures, the governance, the tangible forms of our life and our society, as well as what I'm calling the back of life, the interior mindsets, the worldviews, the very consciousness that shapes the world that we're living in. A couple of weeks ago, we began this series. We started and will continue at the big picture. We started with John Peterson and have explored the extraordinary era of change we're at the leading edge of, the unprecedented shifts that are likely coming. We continued last week with Chris Martinson, looking under the hood at the energy, at the economy, energy, and the environment, three E's, and why the systems as we know it are not sustainable. And today we're going to continue to further explore and look more at the economic and financial system and beyond to understand it, perhaps with even some historical context. Actually, what I'm even proposing that for all of us, that we can even back out and take some sort of an objective look at the system that we're living amidst. Let's get up on the balcony, see more about what's going on. And to do that, I'm thrilled to have a special guest today, James Quilligan, Executive Director of the Center for Global Negotiations. He's been a policy advisor, analyst, and writer for many international politicians and leaders, including Pierre Trudeau, François Mitterrand, Willy Brandt, Jimmy Carter, and more recently, His Royal Highness, Prince Al-Hassan of Jordan, and those are just a few. He's also been an economic consultant for government agencies in 26 countries at least. James and I also served together on the board of the Cosmos Journal, where I've gotten to know James personally, and I'm thrilled to have him here. The quality of James's thinking, his experience is truly rich. Welcome, James. Thanks for joining us here on Zoom today.
Hey, John. Nice to be here. Thanks for inviting me, and I'm really eager to discuss these issues with you.
Yeah, likewise. Likewise. We've had some conversation over over months and so forth, but I'm thrilled to have you here today. And maybe get started. You know, I've been over the weekend looking at The Economist, $3 trillion later, and the write-downs in banking. I see the market's up about 175 points today. This financial and economic crisis, maybe we can understand it better from your standpoint. What is going on? What is your sense of this, James?
Well, yeah, you mentioned $3 trillion of write-downs. That's exactly it. And but that's been underwritten by taxpayers, of course, who have been pouring all that money into their banks and financial institutions. And, you know, essentially, what it boils down to is postponing the inevitable in many ways, because we really haven't faced the structural problems yet. For one thing, we haven't really begun to re-regulate the banks and the financial institutions, and that would be the first step. But certainly the stimulus has created some optimism, the green shoots phenomenon, and there's some reasons for hope. there's been some easing in global financial conditions, and there's been a pickup in economic growth in China. It seems like U.S. home sales have begun to bottom out a little bit. House construction is stabilizing, it would seem. And there's been a little bit of an increase in U.S. consumer spending. So maybe there are some green shoots. Let's hope it's not only spring fever, the euphoria that we're feeling in the springtime. But the contraction in house construction in the United States is, even though it's slowing, that's not enough of an indicator to really hang our hat on. The real problem is that even with the aid from the stimulus tax breaks and the benefit payments that are coming, unless the U.S. jobs market improves really sharply, it's hard to see where consumers are going to find the money to support significant increases in spending. So, you know, it's possible that this green shoots is going to sustain the contraction and the stagnation in U.S. private demand. But if it doesn't, and I don't believe it's going to, I think by the fall we're going to find ourselves back where we were. And in the long run, the United States could easily find itself like Japan in the 1990s, not collapsing, but it's unable to sustain a long-term strong recovery, and it's going to require repeated fiscal stimulus. So real-world recovery at that point would come only with an adequate replacement source of global demand, and it could come from Asia in combination with Europe, but that could take a long time. So I think we're in for a real sustained downturn, and we haven't experienced anything like this for quite some time.
Well, you know, I have to say, James, I've really gotten obsessed with this myself and really, really trying to tune into this, and I spend an inordinate amount of time really tuning into this. And I have to say that, you know, there is the mantra and what I've come to call the siren song that you get out of the Wall Street dimension of it. But underneath it, and in the conversation we've been having over the last 2 weeks, it really does point to a system in great difficulty. And that there, that as you're describing, that some real sort of a down flow here could be occurring for some time. But I'm wondering, as we're talking about this, James, if we can get up onto maybe even a bigger view and up on the balcony a little higher, because that there's the nature of the system itself, and maybe if we can step back from that and maybe even if you could paint a picture of the system as you see it, and maybe how it's evolved, or maybe even some historical context, just to get a sense of this system and what's at play and what's in it, what might be missing, maybe orient those of us here who are not economists and financial people to what you might be seeing.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, essentially, I think this is a monetary crisis, and it's certainly a financial crisis, but beyond that, it's it has to do with our currency and its stability. And to really understand that, we have to get into that bigger picture or that higher elevation and look down and see what's really going on here. We're very familiar with the debate between the public sector and the private sector, and that's, you know, our politics reinforce that consciousness for us all the time, and it actually blinds us to some of their larger realities. That it seems like there's this real strong polarization between the public and private sector, and in some instances, and that's very true, and we certainly see that up close through the political lens. But in other instances, the public and private sector have been working together very closely, and we see that now with the bailout of the banks. I mean, it didn't take too much convincing of Congress to pony up the money to bail out the banks. So there's a coziness here that is, it actually is a little bit worrisome if we're concerned with the long-term prospects of democracy. But that aside, let's just look at this structurally and historically. The relationship between the public and private sector in Western liberal democracies has evolved over a period of several hundred years. And historically, really, it's based on several things. It's based on a monetary system that relies on interest rates. And the interest rates drive artificial consumption. That means that in order to pay off the indebted money supply, people have to increase their consumption, and corporations or companies, suppliers, have to increase their supply of products so that this consumption can be increased. So there's a push toward economic growth in this type of economy. That's the first thing to be aware of. And the second thing, I think, is that historically this has meant that we've enclosed what we had known previously as the commons, lands that really had been unclaimed that now suddenly had private property rights, legal ownership, and it was those enclosed areas that provided the material goods, natural resources that were needed to provide collateral to enhance this economic growth that was driven by these interest rates that were developed. So interest rates increase at a gradient that is much higher than the gradient of the natural resource replenishment rates. And that is the source of much of the problem today. We've enclosed the commons. We've used it as collateral to provide a means by which we can increase economic growth. And it's now coming back to haunt us because we're in the process of having divided the commons to such an extent that it's undermining the sustainability. It's creating poverty, creating the environmental degradation that we're so familiar with.
So, James, let's continue this. I think you're introducing something that's an important one to get, and that is this public-private orientation, potentially the tension and the relationship to the commons. We're up on a break here. Let's pick up that when we get back. This is Zoomed Leadership. John Schmidt here. Come back in a minute.
When it comes to business,
you'll find the experts here.
Voice America Business Network. The world is in flux, primed for a great transition, possibly an epical one. How does it impact you? Does it reshape the questions you ask? The way you view leadership? Today's complexities and challenges call for new realms of leadership. The world needs resilience and adaptability, new levels of innovation and brilliance. At Avastone Consulting, we know that our times call for shifts of mind. How do we cultivate real shifts of mind in our leaders? Not through conventional development, which focuses on gaining skills and knowledge within an established worldview. Shifts of mind truly expand the worldview itself, enlarge the capacity to see through new eyes, and transform interpretations of reality and the actions that accompany them. Those who embrace shifts of mind are the kind of leaders that Avastone helps to build. Change the way you pursue the future. Call Avastone Consulting at 1-678-461-8888. That's 1-678-461-8880. Or visit avastoneconsulting.com. Avastone Consulting, your source for leadership development, working with complex organizations toward evolutionary shifts of mind.
The following commercial is sponsored by FeedThePig.org, an organization devoted to helping you save money. We will not entice you with messages like,
lowest prices in town, dealer approved, certified pre-owned,
no obligation consultation,
nor will we brag about our
huge selection, enormous variety,
one-stop shopping,
everything under one roof,
or promise,
prices reduced up to 75%.
A sale like this can't go on forever.
Factory liquidation,
financing options available.
We will offer no contingencies like,
see store for details.
Prices and participation may vary.
Legal exclusions apply.
No purchase necessary.
We'll try to convince you that our product will give you
leaner, tighter abs in minutes.
Perfect smile. Porcelain veneers.
Freedom from those painful, embarrassing bunions.
Because we simply want to help you spend smarter and save better. Log on to feedthepig.org. Find the benefits of saving for every stage of life. Brought to you by the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants and the Ad Council.
Streaming live, the leader in Internet talk radio, VoiceAmerica.com.
You're listening to Zoomed Leadership with your host, John Schmidt. For more information about John and our program, visit avastoneconsulting.com. That's A-V-A-S-T-O-N-E consulting.com. Now, back to Zoomed Leadership.
Okay, back with James Quilligan. And to pick up, James, where we were, you were describing in our first segment the nature of the system and this public-private, in some respects, coziness, but feels to me at the same time that there are some tensions here at play. When I tune into this and see the private pushing back on the public and all of this going on, can you say a little bit more about that, James, and then let's bridge more back into the commons as well. But what about this tension?
Well, classical economics has always promoted, classical market theory has always promoted the interests of the private sector. And as we know, Keynesian economics promoted the interests of the state intervening in the economy. So that's been kind of the dialectic in the United States for quite some time. And we've convinced many of the other countries to follow the same sort of, you could call it a dichotomy, in the debate between, you know, whether or not the private sector should have more emphasis or the public sector, meaning the state, should have more emphasis. And although there's a lot of cooperation there, there's also this inherent tension, as you said, or a sort of inherent conflict between the interests of both. And it's actually that conflict that has given rise to the recognition that there needs to be a third sector. There needs to be a kind of synthesis of the two, which has a completely independent character to it. So, in other words, it includes some aspects of the public sector, private, and the private sector, but it also goes beyond them and has another inherent kind of property to it. And I would suggest that that new third sector is the commons. It's neither public or private. It includes some properties of both, but it also has a whole new character.
So how would you actually define the commons then, James? It's a little bit, there's some properties of the both, but separate. How would you define it?
Well, commons are pretty familiar to us, but we just don't have a lot of language for it. They're areas of shared space or mutual interest and worth that the public and private sectors don't usually include on their balance sheets, and they try not to monetize them. In many cases, they can't monetize them because they're beyond monetizing. You can't commodify some of these commons. So, in other words, the commons involve different kinds of relationships. It involves meaning and wealth that link us to the things that we share and need for our livelihood. And they can be commons. Generally, a lot of people think of natural resources as commons, but the commons really go beyond that. They can include actually a kind of a credit commons, in meaning our purchasing power. They can be also including indigenous wisdom and traditions. They can also refer to our collective health, our social development, community ties, labor relations, women's and children's freedom, different religious and ethnic traditions and values. Language is also a commons. Intellectual property is a commons. Communication flows, cultural openness and musical expression, literary, artistic expression, as well as natural resources, the seas, the fisheries, land, forests, water, air. Those are some familiar commons, but also the protection of genetic life forms and species. So all of those can be considered commons because they fall outside of the realm of the state, and they also fall outside of the realm of the private sector.
Interesting, James. So you really expanded that in this conversation for me and probably for some of our listeners, too, that, you know, often we think about the commons, we think about air, and we think about water, and we think about the seas and the seabeds and a number of those dimensions that are part of the environment and that what's common to life. But what you're describing here, going back to my introduction, feels as if it has some dimension to it of some interiority, I mean, some sense of the culture and the indigenous wisdom. And some of the elements you're describing there go beyond some of the typical ways we might think of commons.
That's right. And I think there's an emerging definition of this new intersubjectivity that sees itself as a third entity, third sector that's beyond the public sphere, beyond the private sphere. And as a result, there's a continuum or a spectrum of all kinds of different things that we're quite familiar with, but that that really have similar characteristics, even though some of these commons are replenishable and some aren't replenishable. That's not the distinguishing characteristic. So many of our natural resources, for example, aren't replenishable, but, you know, artistic commons is replenishable. We can continue to create, or intellectual property is replenishable. We can continue to develop that. But that's not the key difference. And in fact, that blurs some of the distinctions and has made it easy for the public and private sectors to enclose the commons and to commodify them. This doesn't necessarily mean that the public and private sectors don't have legitimate space in order to create their own value. It's just that much of the value coming from the commons has not been respected and has been expropriated to the extent that the resources themselves have not been replenished, and the people who use the resources in many cases and depend on them for their own livelihood have not been compensated for the expropriation of many of these commons. So, in a sense, the idea of this is trying to preserve value back in the local areas. And, of course, it's not only the local areas. The commons can be state commons. It can be interstate. That means crossing over borders. It can be regional, and it can even be global in scope, like the atmosphere.
So you're starting to get to my question here, that when you're talking about why is this important, you're starting to point to it by saying that there is some sense of the certain resources which aren't being replenished, they're being used or expropriated, and in some cases we're beyond the sustainable limits in many of these resources, as Chris was talking about last week. But can you say a little bit more about why is it important for us, James, to recognize this third sector, this common sector?
Well, you know, the idea of the commons was kind of put on the map back in the 1960s by Garrett Hardin in an essay that he wrote called The Tragedy of the Commons. And he pointed out that if there was a few goat herders that were sharing their space and they were grazing, it wouldn't be too much of a problem if the resources that they were grazing on could continue to grow. But if more and more sheep herders came into that space and began to really damage the environment, then that would be a real tragedy. And the whole point is that if we have shared space and we want to provide resources from a commons to a growing group of users, it can lead to disaster. And we certainly relate that with the ecological problems that are taking place today. But it's also, we see the same kind of thing in other kinds of commons. I mean, just to stay on point here, others have said, well, you know, historically that has happened. We have damaged the commons, but where people come together and create rules to manage their commons, in many cases, the commons thrive and support the people who live there, and they can really flourish. And the people generally live in a lot more prosperity and happiness than if they had not created those rules and just there was a sense that anything goes, that there was a deregulation of the commons, and then the commons were given zero value and then could be commodified and privatized. So here we're talking about ways of preserving commons that insulate them to some extent from the private and public sectors in order to regenerate resources and also to benefit the people who use those resources.
So what I'm hearing you say is we're taking care of those things that are common to us, that are difficult to take care of by the focus of the private sector, which is more oriented to the shorter-term gain, shorter-term profitability, the freedom to do that. And from the public standpoint, it's more difficult to do that. And I'm curious about some of the perspectives about why that might be. And I know we're heading toward a break here, but this might be a place, James, to begin to at least introduce some of the thoughts about this. So why is it that the public sector can't really deal with what we're talking about in the commons?
Sure. How much time do we have then?
We've got about the closing minute here. Maybe we can use this as an introduction to where we might go to distinguish the private sector from the nature of the commons.
Mm-hmm. Well, the private sector and the private sector is pretty easy to understand. We see pretty clearly what that is. The public sector, it's easy to confuse it because we have to distinguish the public from the commons. And when we say public, we really mean the state. And the state has a legitimate role in providing state services, roads and schools and hospitals and parks and things like that that we're pretty familiar with. But the state historically is not a very good protector of natural resources or other kinds of commons like indigenous traditions and community ties and labor relations and artistic freedom and those kinds of things. The state is not equipped to be able to handle those kinds of things as well as people who live within a commons. They're the ones who are most directly involved in it, and therefore they're the ones who really feel as though they have a better insight into how to co-manage those commons.
Well, that's a good point for us to pick up on there, James, when we come back in just a minute, and that is that distinction of the commons and the public sector not being able to effectively manage that. We'll be back with James Quilligan in just a minute.
The Internet's number one talk station.
Number one talk station.
VoiceAmerica.com.
The world is in flux, primed for a great transition, possibly an epical one. How does it impact you? Does it reshape the questions you ask? The way you view leadership? Today's complexities and challenges call for new realms of leadership. The world needs resilience and adaptability, new levels of innovation and brilliance. At Avastone Consulting, we know that our times call for shifts of mind. How do we cultivate real shifts of mind in our leaders? Not through conventional development, which focuses on gaining skills and knowledge within an established worldview. Shifts of mind truly expand the worldview itself, enlarge the capacity to see through new eyes, and transform interpretations of reality and the actions that accompany them. Those who embrace shifts of mind are the kind of leaders that Avastone helps to build. Change the way you pursue the future. Call Avastone Consulting at 1-678-461-8888. That's 1-678-461-8880. Or visit avastoneconsulting.com. Avastone Consulting, your source for leadership development, working with complex organizations toward evolutionary shifts of mind.
Janine Marks, a 12-year-old, was fairly normal. She spent a lot of time online. One day, she met a new friend. The new friend had the same problems at home. They liked the same bands. They worried about the same subjects in school. They promised to keep each other's secrets. They wished they went to the same junior high. The new friend had good news. He said he was going to be in Janine's area one Saturday. He thought it would be amazing if they could just hang out, go to the mall. Janine agreed. The new friend didn't want parents messing this up. Janine showed up alone. So did her new friend, who wasn't in junior high, wasn't nice, and wasn't a 14-year-old boy. Every day, children are sexually solicited online. Help delete online predators. Call 1-800-THE-LOST or visit cybertipline.com to learn how to protect your kids' online life. A message from the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children and the Ad Council.
The Internet's number one talk station.
Number one talk station.
VoiceAmerica.com.
You're listening to Zoomed Leadership with your host, John Schmidt. For more information about John and our program, visit avastoneconsulting.com. That's A-V-A-S-T-O-N-E consulting.com. Now, back to Zoomed Leadership.
Back with James Quilligan. And James, pick up on this. We were talking about the nature of the public sector not being able to effectively deal with the issues of the commons. And my sense is that might have something to do with the fact that we have boundaries and border issues of the public and the public state, so to speak. But say some more about that. Why is it that the public sector isn't able to effectively deal with the commons issues?
Well, you know, for one thing, they don't have the expertise because they're not living with the commons like the local people are. And the other thing is that they are vested into protecting borders, and they give more credence to that. And so they're not as concerned with the replenishment of commons as they are with the borders that define the commons. That's really what they're trying to enforce more than they are the quality of life within the commons. I mean, that's generally the case as you look around the world. A lot of this has to do with how we define sovereign borders today. And, you know, but the real thing here is that when people recognize that the carrying capacity of their commons doesn't support the achievement of their needs and well-being through the available resources that are there, then they have a moral and empirical obligation to reorganize the way that their commons value is managed. And that's happening more and more. A lot of people are returning to their commons to create institutions. Now, this involves people trying to create an open internet, also organizing around indigenous cultures and organizing around women's rights and many of the things that the non-governmental organizations or civil society across the world are doing today actually have to do with protecting the commons. And it's that new movement that's outside of the public sector that has developed because those folks have recognized that, you know, the private sector or the public, meaning government sector, have not been able to effectively manage and protect the value of the resources on those commons.
So what I'm hearing then is as we, the private and the public sector together, to use your language, if we think of that more as the market state as we know it, because it's not able to effectively deal with the commons, now we're having more of an arising that's coming out of civil society, or potentially organizations are mobilizing to put attention to the commons, to orient the level of focus and the managing of that to be done. It's interesting, James, and it brings the question to me then of, is this happening on a local basis, and how does that connect to the global basis, or is there some dichotomy, or is that somehow need to be in sync at the same time?
Well, civil society, once they recognize that they are commons organizations, and they haven't really been able to do that yet, I think they'll resolve some of this duality that's involved right now. But for the most part, at the moment, people who organize in their own communities recognize themselves as opposed to globalization and opposed to overarching international developments that are addressing commons issues, because the people just generally recognize that naturally that they want to protect the value in their communities. And that's the local dimension, and that's fantastic when that happens. The problem, though, is that there are a lot of issues around the commons that are global in scope. There are international institutions that are trying to address those problems. So the dichotomy comes in when we only want to address them on a local basis and not really respect the fact that they are global. Many of them are global in scope. So it's a very difficult kind of duality to transcend. However, it has to be done because the duality can lead to a lot of antagonism between local communities who see global efforts to preserve the commons as being another form of globalization, when in fact there are many international institutions that are working on global commons problems. For example, world hunger and solving the global environmental crisis and the Law of the Sea Treaty and the difficulties with the Arctic now, and it's melting, and many people have claims and they want to tap oil and gas from the Arctic. All of these are really global commons problems, and it doesn't mean that we can't continue to address the local commons problems. It's just that we've got to be able to create a continuum where we understand that all of them are commons problems, even though we may think of them in different terms, like local and global.
So from a leadership standpoint, it seems to me we're even talking about reframing, and we're reframing in two ways, James. One is we're reframing the need for something beyond the public and private and the market state, so to speak, that we're reframing that we need to begin to recognize the commons and a common sector. But it sounds to me it's interesting that we're reframing this in a more whole as well, as it revolves around the local and the global, that there is a connection here, and it's not to create an artificial boundary, in that if I'm really working on the local issues that I want to put my arm up and say, no, anything that's global, stay away, we're doing this, that there's some greater holism to be looked at and some harmonic that needs to be worked out of this civil sovereignty or civil society and the sovereignty that might come with that. Can you say a little bit more, though? It's interesting to me, this local to globals, but not over. You used the word earlier about the spectrum, perhaps, of the commons from replenishable aspects and those that are non-replenishable. How does that all come to bear here, and how can we even provide some more clarity about what needs to emerge that's not even yet well-framed?
Well, yeah, this is a really key question. There are a lot of civil society organizations out there who are working in different areas. They don't necessarily see that they have any linkages whatsoever. And there are some people who have mapped all the varieties of these different civil society groups who are working on commons issues. And they're indicating that they really need not organize because there is no common basis on which to organize. But the fact is, they do have a common basis, and that's that they're all involved in commons issues, even though there is a spectrum of differences. And as you'd said, and we talked earlier about the fact that some of the commons are replenishable, and some are non-replenishable, particularly some of the natural resource commons. So there seems to be some inherent differences there, but there really aren't, because once we get into this and recognize that there are ways of organizing on the commons in order to create rules and institutions to manage those commons, then the distinctions between the replenishable and the non-replenishable commons begin to blur. We've got to recognize that the protection and the allocation and regulation of various kinds of commons involve experimenting with new kinds of approaches to participatory management outside, again, of the public and private spheres who are not really geared to protect those commons. So this means creating new kinds of institutions and agreements to negotiate the uses of the commons among all the stakeholders and create effective ways of holding them all accountable. So there are groups and associations and movements that spring up that promote the mutual interests of citizens that are directly represented in preserving this collective wealth.
So this isn't in any way, shape, or form diminishing the value and contribution of the private sector, nor diminishing the reality of what the public sector can bring to life, and that there is some positive benefit and an underpinning to this system. But what you're describing here is going beyond that and reframing this and bringing forward some emergence out of this, out of the commons, and how that can be organized and structured to be able to do that. And it seems in some respects, James, as we're really starting to point to the orientation to value, that we're creating value out of the private sector, creating value out of the public sector, and there were in some respects out of this honoring the nature of value that's somehow not explicitly included in the system as we know it today. Is that sort of where this is going to?
Absolutely right, and that's what a topic that I'd really like to get into, because that's where all this is heading, that the commons has a source of value that has been ignored, and in fact, we have to, as citizens, we have to reclaim that value, and really that's what all the civil society groups are doing, but they haven't understood that's what they're up to, because they haven't identified themselves as commons organizations yet, but there needs to be more education about what the commons is so that people really clearly see it, and then more awareness among these groups that is exactly what they're trying to provide, is a new sense of value, whether it's a hunger group or a anti-poverty group or environmental group or women's rights or children's rights or the rights of indigenous peoples, whatever it might be. We're trying to create new value. We're trying to increase the value of those domains, which I think is very, very important. And there are ways of doing that outside of the public and private sector.
Well, great. That's, I think, the topic for our last segment then here, James, is the nature of that value and the nature of that wealth in many respects that may not be distinctively distinguished and really captured relative to the public and private sector. We'll be back in a minute for the closing sector here, section here and segment with James Quilligan. This is Zoomed Leadership.
Streaming live, the leader in Internet talk radio, VoiceAmerica.com.
The world is in flux, primed for a great transition, possibly an epical one. How does it impact you? Does it reshape the questions you ask? The way you view leadership? Today's complexities and challenges call for new realms of leadership. The world needs resilience and adaptability, new levels of innovation and brilliance. At Avastone Consulting, we know that our times call for shifts of mind. How do we cultivate real shifts of mind in our leaders? Not through conventional development, which focuses on gaining skills and knowledge within an established worldview. Shifts of mind truly expand the worldview itself, enlarge the capacity to see through new eyes, and transform interpretations of reality and the actions that accompany them. Those who embrace shifts of mind are the kind of leaders that Avastone helps to build. Change the way you pursue the future. Call Avastone Consulting at 1-678-461-8880. That's 1-678-461-8880. Or visit avastoneconsulting.com. Avastone Consulting, your source for leadership development, working with complex organizations toward evolutionary shifts of mind.
The Marsh Engel Show. Join the movement to empower yourself with the essentials of feminine power and success, and learn how women around the world are becoming more inspired, more influential, and absolutely amazing. Each week, Marsh sits down for an engaging conversation with women who are boldly committed to living their most amazing life. You'll discover ways to step into your greatest vision, deepen your relationships, and unleash your real creative brilliance. Get ready. It's time to jump into the conversation. That's Monday afternoons at 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern for the Marsh Engel Show on the Voice America Business Network.
you need directions to solid financial future? If so, the Money Answers Show with Jordan Goodman will provide you with a roadmap to making smart money decisions in every area of your personal finances. Join Jordan every Monday at 12 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, 3 p.m. Eastern, for the Money Answers Show on the Voice America Business Channel. Learn how and where to get the best deals on mortgages, cars, and insurance. Find out the best ways to save for college and retirement. Get out of debt, improve your credit rating, and save on your taxes. The Money Answers Show with Jordan Goodman will provide you with great tips on investment opportunities in real estate, stocks, annuities, and other investment vehicles. That's the Money Answers Show with Jordan Goodman on the Voice America Business Channel every Monday at 12 p.m. Pacific Standard Time.
Stimulating talk.
It gets those synapses in the brain firing really fast.
All the time.
The number one internet talk station where your opinion counts. VoiceAmerica.com.
You're listening to Zoomed Leadership with your host, John Schmidt. For more information about John and our program, visit avastoneconsulting.com. That's A-V-A-S-T-O-N-E consulting.com. Now, back to Zoomed Leadership.
Okay, back with James Quilligan, final segment, talking about the nature of the larger system we're in. We've really, really talked more about the global commons and the commons in general, local and global, and we've really starting to explore more about the value of this, James. So maybe you can pick up on that here in our last segment.
Okay, John, I'd be happy to. One thing I just want to remind us now, when we say commons, we might just think exclusively of natural resources, but there is a mental commons and a social commons, a cultural commons, as well as an ecological commons. And that's the nature of this, that there's a spectrum of commons that we really haven't completely linked together yet. And that's the whole point of our identifying the commons here, I think, in recently. A lot of people are creating these links and identifying it in this way because there's a lot of power in this. And one of the ways that we can express that power is to find new ways of creating value. Now, there's one source of value that we can create which is non-monetized, and that has to do with, as we know in a community, just generating greater synergy through trust and cooperation and greater dialogue and therefore greater quality of life, because we're working outside of the money system, where whether it's through barter or alternative currencies or just purely working in a gift economy where there's a lot of sharing involved and redistributing resources that are completely non-monetized. And then there's another way of creating value in a commons, and it has a little bit more to do with monetizing the commons, but in a way that doesn't benefit the state or the private sector. And this has to do with creating green fees on certain natural resources that that really involve the common heritage resource use, such as emissions into the air, carbon emissions. And we know the cap and trade debate is alive and well in Washington now, although I don't think cap and trade is the way to go, but certainly a carbon emissions tax or fee, and that fee being able to go back into addressing climate change and providing dividends to people who have had health problems as a result of air pollution and things like that. In other words, the monies themselves would go back right into the field rather than go through the coffers of the state or go through the coffers of the private sector. And it's not just carbon emissions, it's emissions into water or into the soil that's important, that we could create new fees that would regenerate these resources as well as protect some of the people in that particular commons. This also involves public lands that include timber and grazing and mining. It involves the electromagnetic spectrum. There could be a fee on the use of that. It would include the G-orbital zones or the satellite parking spaces that we have. There could be a fee for those that would also generate our ability to clean up some of the space debris that's out there. A fee on certain oil and minerals and ocean fisheries and water resources. Those are all potential areas, as well as international jet fuel and international airline travel and things that cross international borders like maritime trade, international financial flows. There's long been a talk about a Tobin tax on international financial speculation that could help regulate the international financial industry, which has no regulation whatsoever currently. These are all potential areas where fees could be assessed that could benefit the commons by creating new sources of value that would go, again, back directly into the area of trying to reconstitute the depleted commons and generate tangible dividends for the people who need or use those resources or who suffer the effects of their displacement.
So what you're really describing here, value, which is money, and it's value in ways that does have to do with money, but it sounds, James, as this is coming out of the commons through some emerging organization and flow of structure that would support this, and an orientation to this common sector in a way that sounds to me this is an emergent arena of development as we go forward, that this is just now kind of coming onto the scene, and that organizations, the non-governmental organizations, maybe that's a closing question for you, are the NGOs of the world attuned to the commons in this way? They're working these issues, and I know we only just have a couple of minutes left here, but are they really attuned to this, or is this something that's really emerging and an area for us to continue to look at and focus on?
It's still emerging. Some civil society groups are aware of this, but they don't see any way of organizing it. A number of international groups have been talking about it for some time under the topic of multilateral financing for alternative development or alternative financing for development. And so it's been discussed for quite some time, but it hasn't been discussed that broadly at the local level, and now's the time to really introduce this to the local commons groups across the world. The commons groups across the world have to begin to identify themselves as commons groups. They don't necessarily see themselves that way yet, and they've got to define exactly what it is that they do in terms of the commons, and then see how the commons is a really big picture kind of area. And you know, it's not exclusionary of the private and public sectors. The cooperation of public and private sectors is absolutely necessary in furthering this goal. But in cases where the private and public sectors have encroached too heavily on the commons, then some of that has to be rolled back and to protect the commons. And really, that's what's going on. It is an emergent process, but it's really booming, and it's developing in pockets all over the place. So there's a lot of great potential here.
Well, James, maybe this is a good point. I would like to, we can only lick the ice cream cone, I think, in some respects on this, and it seems to me this is a continuing point of discussion, and perhaps we can even take this on another show and bring a case study forward to talk about this and the nature of what's going on. But let me personally thank you, James, for starting this discussion with us, pointing to it. Center for Global Negotiations is where you can find James. I'd also point you to the Cosmos Journal, the spring issue, in which James has a groundbreaking feature, The Commons and Integral Capital. Take a look at it. If you're not familiar with the Cosmos Journal, I would say go to it. It is a great publication. You'll certainly interested into it. Next week, we're going to be recorded on Memorial Day. Join us 2 weeks for a live show, June 1st, when we continue on the issues of our times, the real work of leadership, and the support that we need to them. Thanks. This is John Schmidt, Zoomed Leadership. See you then soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you again for listening to Zoomed Leadership with host John Schmidt. Please be sure to join us again next Monday at 11 a.m. Pacific Time, 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel, and have a terrific week.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.